KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic has drawn international scrutiny and even pity from the world outside the United States. How is it that a nation that has for decades boasted of its scientific prowess and innovation has so badly bungled its response to an entirely predictable health emergency? The backstory is a lengthy one, and it's the subject of a new book by my guest Clifford Connor, who lays out chapter by chapter what he calls the tragedy of American science. Clifford Connor is a historian of science at the School of Professional Studies at the CUNY Graduate Center. He's the author of A People's History of Science, and the full title of his latest book is The Tragedy of American Science, From Truman to Trump. Welcome to the program, Clifford.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So first, let's talk about what you open your book with, which is a very interesting issue, one that has, has gripped many people in this country for many years and is often in the news and makes lots of headlines, and that is nutrition science. Nutrition science is such an interesting story, and it's where you start your book. Many people even wonder if much of the science that's done on nutrition is sound. Why do you start your book there?
Well, first of all, I started the book with nutrition science because I think often nutrition science doesn't get much respect from the general public. It often seems to be the butt of jokes, as a matter of fact, but it's extremely important, and therefore its integrity is important. It's important because everybody has a stake in the accuracy of information about the food that we eat. Almost half the adult population of the United States, 133 million people, has at least one of the four leading diet-related health problems: heart disease, stroke, cancer, or diabetes. These chronic conditions are responsible for 7 out of 10 deaths in the United States every year. But nutrition science in particular has been plagued by research reports that are misleading, unscientific, and manipulated to draw dubious conclusions. It's been all too obvious, and that's why the general public treats it with such skepticism. One prime example is how the official federal dietary recommendations have been manipulated for decades by the sugar industry, not only by the sugar producers themselves, but by the big food corporations that use sugar in their products, especially like Coca-Cola, Kellogg's, General Mills, Hershey, and many of the others. These companies fund nutrition research, and they make sure that the results they pay for satisfy their public relations needs. It's the opposite of trustworthy science. So I devoted the first chapter of the book to the corruption of nutrition science as an extreme example of the many ways in which science and the service of corporate profits has been manipulated and falsified.
So your book sort of lays out that the twin plagues of American science are corporate influence and military influence, the desire to have American science serve militarism. So corporations whose interest is never human health is always the bottom line, their profits by design, that's literally how they're designed, have often been the sponsors of scientific studies. Nutrition, of course, is a big one because food is always going to be in demand. And you pointed out sugary drinks as one issue the sugar industry holds sway over. There's another aspect of the corporatization of science and the sort of perversion of science that's one of the most popular examples, and that is big tobacco, which you also write about, how the tobacco industry claimed to use science and scientific studies to basically push their profits. Why is this part of the tragedy of American science?
I think the topic of tobacco science has become so familiar that I don't think I can say much about it that most informed readers don't already know. The criminality of the tobacco industry is well known thanks to a popular book and documentary film entitled Merchants of Doubt by historians of science Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway. On the other hand, it's such an important and outrageous contributor to the tragedy of contemporary science that it can't be ignored or left out of the conversation. It's important because since the advent of mass-produced cigarettes, lung cancer has risen from being a rare condition, representing only 1% of all cancers, to its present status as the number one cause of cancer deaths for both men and women in the United States. Its primary strategy was to inject doubt about legitimate scientific conclusions into the national conversation, and by doing that, to manufacture a public controversy that didn't exist at all among scientists, and then to demand equal time in the mass media for both sides of these contrived disputes.
Right.
And as I said, unfortunately, this strategy worked all too well and has been imitated by other industries, most notably the fossil fuel industries, who manufactured a false debate over the reality of global warming and climate change.
Let's talk about the pharmaceutical industry. Very relevant in the world we live in today with the coronavirus pandemic. People watch the news with bated breath about the development of a vaccine. There is an attempt by the administration to politicize science, and the pharmaceutical companies, of course, know that their profits rely on people trusting their products. So the pharmaceutical industry, which of course is the most direct line between the corporatization of science and the products they create and human health, if you will, and maybe second only to food. How does the pharmaceutical industry undermine science and American science in particular?
Well, here again, we can talk about the COVID-19 pandemic as raising this whole issue to a new stage in the tragedy of American science. The tragedy has been elevated onto an even higher plane. I think almost everybody's aware of the problems that are caused by the pharmaceutical industry. Well, for one thing, pricing their products too high for most people to afford in a country where we don't have adequate health insurance. One big example recently has been the issue of opioids. There was an actual branch of science called pain management science, and it started out pretty good. It started out as a legitimate science, but before long, the large pharmaceutical companies found that they could manipulate it, and they began doing that in order to change the narrative from being cautious about opioids to, oh, opioids, no problem. And so that was a clear case of corruption of an important pharmaceutical issue and at last count, I understand, I think it's something like 400,000 Americans have died directly from the abuse of that science.
Let's also get to the militarization aspect of American science. We've been talking a lot about how corporate profits have attempted to use science to distort the scientific process and to distort results. What about the U.S. military, considered the most advanced military in the world today by far? Certainly, we spend more on the U.S. military than any other country, not just by a small amount, but by a huge amount. How does the U.S. military, how has science been used, if you will, in the service of the U.S. military? And is that where the from Truman to Trump part of your book really comes in?
Yes, it does. In looking into this question, I tried to find out where everything went wrong. And it seems that it happened right after World War II. The thing that changed about the way science is practiced in the United States, especially since World War II, came out of the Manhattan Project, which developed the first atomic bomb. And of course, if you wanted an icon for the beginning of the tragedy of American science, you could use the mushroom clouds rising over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Truman ordered the dropping of those bombs. So that's why the subtitle of the book is From Truman to Trump. And Trump is obvious. Anyway, let me get into the militarization you asked for, and I'll quote a line one quick line directly from the book. Science and technology, rather than being the creative engines of human progress, have instead been reoriented toward destructive and anti-human ends. And that's the message of the first half, or the second half of the book, I should say. I have to say that, in my opinion, this is the most tragic aspect of American science. Most people, I think, expect or at least hope that our scientific institutions will devote their efforts to producing knowledge that will benefit the human race. But unfortunately, the trillions of dollars the American government spends in the name of science are primarily devoted to perfecting military technologies of death, finding new and better ways to kill people in large numbers, from thermonuclear bombs to robot drones, cluster munitions, and anti-personnel weaponry of infinite variety. At a budget hearing a couple of years ago, former defense secretary, James Mattis, gave an unusually frank answer when he was asked why the military needed all the money that they've given them and why he's back in front of them asking for more. And he said, "I need to make the military more lethal." Now, it may sound exaggerated, but when I say trillions of dollars are devoted to military research, not just the whole military budget, but military research in particular, trillions of dollars, that's not every year, but trillions of dollars over a period of time, that's based on official government accounting that actually understates the real size of the expenditures. And I also cite evidence in the book to back up the claim that more than half of the federal science budget goes to the military. Almost everybody is aware of the absurdity of the size of the military budget, and yet in the realm of the public discourse, very little discussion is devoted to seriously dealing with that problem.
Now, some would counter and say, well, okay, even if you don't agree that so much of our money should go toward the development of warfighting machines, there are, good things that come out of it. We've been, the internet and smartphone technology. Is that a good enough argument for you?
Not really, and I'll tell you why. It's because all of that research that produced those things you're talking about, and they are useful. We're talking about civilian technologies. They are useful, but they were accidental byproducts of military research. They were all they all come out of research by DARPA, D-A-R-P-A, the defense. I'm getting lost here. DARPA, D-A-R-P-A, Defense Advanced Projects Research.
The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Exactly. I just looked it up.
it's a tongue twister. But anyway, it's an agency, a very, very, very important agency of the Pentagon, which some people know about. It has a public face, but most people probably have never heard of it. But anyway, military research by DARPA has been responsible for a lot of the civilian technology we know and love. For example, I don't know if you mentioned GPS. That wasn't invented for us. That was invented as a byproduct of satellite technology to guide weapons and identify targets and to aid troop movements.
And now it helps us not get lost on our way home.
Right. And Siri and Alexa, you like to ask them questions, right? Cute little disembodied virtual friends. Well, Steve Jobs and Apple didn't invent Siri. It was a product of a DARPA project called PAL, Personal Assistant That Learns. PAL was the biggest artificial intelligence project in U.S. history. And as I say, its purpose wasn't to entertain us or answer our questions. It was to make the military more lethal, as James Mattis said. DARPA also invented the internet. It was originally called ARPANET because DARPA was ARPA, and they called their invention ARPANET. Facial recognition, that's another DARPA AI project. Self-driving vehicles, that comes from DARPA. It's before DARPA, but even your microwave oven came from military research. So don't be thinking that all that was done for us. It wasn't.
Now, the issue of science in the service of military also comes up quite a bit when we're talking about nuclear technology. You mentioned the atomic bombs and the mushroom clouds over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nuclear power is considered today a clean energy alternative to fossil fuels, and especially in the era of climate change, we're supposed to trust that this is one very important aspect of a portfolio of clean energies. Is that conclusion also perverted by the militarization of science?
Yes, it is. I talk about that quite extensively in the book. There's a chapter on atoms for peace. Atoms for peace was a fraudulent slogan from the very beginning. There was no atoms for peace. That was just for us to believe that they were trying to create energy, not clean energy, by the way. That wasn't even an issue back then at the beginning. Now that's become the slogan, atomic energy can be clean energy. Well, it's not. It's the dirtiest energy in the world. It doesn't create CO2, that's true, but it creates radiation poisoning, which is far worse and far more dangerous than carbon dioxide. So don't let anybody tell you that nuclear energy is clean energy, because it's not. As for the nuclear weapons, this is the first of the anthropogenic existential crises that the human race has faced, and that comes from many decades ago with the threat that the United States and the Soviet Union might somehow get involved in a thermonuclear exchange. And you will have people, apologists for the nuclear power industry and for nuclear weapons, will say, oh, it's very exaggerated to say that that could end the human race. It is not exaggerated. I am absolutely convinced that a relatively small thermonuclear exchange could make the human race extinct. So don't let anybody tell you differently unless you look into it yourself. And if you disagree with me, okay, but I don't think you will if you look into it well. Now, here's the problem. We think about Trump. Trump is outrageously bad in every aspect. The man has never said anything in good faith. But the problem with the nuclear weapons dilemma that we have, and we're still faced with an anthropogenic existential crisis in the possibility of an exchange of nuclear weapons, more than ever now, because now there are, I think, 9 nations. It's not just us and the Soviet Union. There are 9 countries that have the capability now. But anyway, I started to say that the most recent round began with the Obama administration. Obama came into office saying that he wanted to rid the world of nuclear weapons. And that was so wonderful that he won the Nobel Peace Prize for that. About, I think within a month of winning that prize, he had signed a bill to do what they call upgrading the American nuclear arsenal over a number of years for the cost of $30 trillion. And of course, when Obama went out of office and Trump came in, he and his people were just licking their chops. Oh, this is wonderful. We're going to go higher than that. So, you know, it's really, really very, very dangerous.
Well,
and the peace thing, by the way, just let me finish on that. Research and development of civilian nuclear power generation was always a cover for military applications of nuclear energy, which is to say thermonuclear weapons. Okay, sorry.
Well, I just was wondering if we can sort of conclude by looking at, you know, at reminding ourselves how science can actually function and the scientific method and scientific process can function free of these twin evils of corporatism and militarism. The scientific method, you know, young scientists, when they're trained, are taught about the scientific method, are taught to let the results lead their conclusions rather than other influences. What are the kinds of things that you hope can salvage American science?
Sonali, I'm really glad you asked that, because I don't want your listeners to go away from this totally depressed. Most of the book, unfortunately, is focused on what the title says, the tragedy of American science. But in the last chapter, I try to give a little bit of hope, and I do see some grounds for hope. That is the multi-trillion dollar question, as you might say. In the last chapter of the book, I cite the encouraging example of what one very small country with very limited resources has been able to accomplish in the realm of science. I'm talking about Cuba, you might have guessed. What Cuba has going for it is that it isn't burdened with an economic system that's geared only toward increasing the profits of private corporatization, of private corporations. Because of that, it's been able to develop a science for human needs rather than a science for profits. And it's been extremely successful in doing so. Cuban biotechnology and biomedical science have advanced to the forefront of international science. I give quite a few details on this in the book, and I won't go into here. But we have to ask, this is the question, if Cuban science has done so much with so little, what marvels could the mighty engine of American science achieve? What was the path not taken? Just imagine what American science might have accomplished if the many trillions of dollars and the enormous amount of scientific talent wasted on military R&D had instead been devoted to finding solutions to the crucial problems facing the world today: poverty, hunger, disease, environmental devastation, and all the rest. So yes, when it comes to the way science is practiced, a better world is definitely possible. To get there, the first steps are nationalize big pharma, nationalize the fossil fuel industries, nationalize the banks, nationalize the insurance companies, and nationalize the military contractors. But for that to happen, and for it to have any meaning, the nationalized economy has to be administered by a government that's democratically controlled by the people of the country, by you and me and all the rest of us, rather than a tiny, super wealthy elite. And I'll conclude there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Clifford. Good luck with the book, and thanks for spending this time talking about these issues.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Clifford D. Connor. He's a historian of science at the School of Professional Studies at CUNY Graduate Center. His earlier book was A People's History of Science. We've been discussing his latest book, The Tragedy of American Science, From Truman to Trump. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.